Thank you for joining me, all of you, for joining me today. And I welcome all those tuning in live on Radio Maria. As we head towards the end of 2021, I wanted to take this year-end opportunity to update you on UNMISS activities and the situation in South Sudan more generally. I'd like to start with the impact of the flooding, which is of great concern to us all. I was yesterday in Bentiu witnessing firsthand the dramatic way in which the floods have upended hundreds of thousands of people's lives. As you know, more than 800,000 people have been severely affected by the worst floods in maybe a century, particularly in Yonglei, Unity and Upper Nile. Yesterday, as I mentioned, I travelled to Yonglei to see firsthand the impact on communities as well as the work the UN family is doing to assist. I can only describe the situation as dire. Floodwaters are not receding as expected with the change in season, and hundreds of thousands of people remain displaced and in desperate need of aid. Donors have given generously to support humanitarian work across this country for many years, despite significant competing demands to help people in many other conflict-affected and economically deprived locations around the world. We thank them for that. However, right now, our humanitarian partners report that they simply can't bridge the gap in the available funding and resources needed to reach all South Sudanese. The consequences of this situation could be disastrous. We are told that unless urgent assistance is given, more than 2 million people may not have access to basic health services. At least 277,000 acutely malnourished women and children will be at further risk. 70,000 children won't be able to go to school, and without adequate water, sanitation and hygiene, there is the potential for an outbreak of cholera or other waterborne diseases. A huge collective effort is underway to support communities in need, involving humanitarians, our peacekeepers, and the development community. But more help is needed if we are to address this devastating situation. Of particular concern to me is the deterioration of the infrastructure of berms and dikes. Water will still be there when the next rainy season comes. Unless we can avert this, we may even have to consider evacuating people from the area. I will raise this issue, as well as the situation more generally in South Sudan, in my regular update to the United Nations Security Council next week. In that briefing, I will highlight the commendable progress made by the parties, that's the parties to the ARCUS, since the signing of the peace agreement, but also note that the pace of implementation remains too slow, a fact that was acknowledged even by the President at the Governor's Conference. If this continues, there is a risk that the viability of the broader agreement will come under threat, which is a concern raised by analysts and commentators recently. Put simply, there cannot be a business-as-usual approach. The parties must inject fresh urgency into the process and demonstrate a sustained collective political will to finalise critical areas of the agreement. This includes the transitional security arrangements, legislation promoting financial and judicial reforms, and constitution making so that elections can be held. Concrete action in these areas will allow the international community, and UNMISS in particular, to play a greater role in providing support to the government and people of South Sudan. UNMISS continues to actively support the peace process as an impartial partner, working alongside political actors and other stakeholders to support locally driven initiatives. To give you an idea of the work we've carried out so far this year, we have hosted at least 10 constitution-making and electoral workshops, 11 forums for political parties, leadership retreats for newly appointed state authorities, and supported governors' forums in each of the states and administrative areas, culminating with the recent successful high-level governors' meeting in Juba. At the grassroots, we've led more than 170 conflict resolution and peace-building activities, resulting in the signing of 34 local peace agreements. These activities involved more than 30,000 participants, a significant percentage of which were women and youth. As you know, it is the primary responsibility of the government to protect its citizens and ensure that their needs are being met. However, the UN is providing support within the limits of our capacity in terms of protection, recovery and development. In providing protection, we are taking proactive and robust action by rapidly deploying to areas where there is a threat or actual violence. Our military peacekeepers have carried out between 6,000 and 7,000 patrols across the country by ground, air and river. We've established more than 125 temporary bases in conflict hotspots to deter violence and especially to enable the safe delivery of humanitarian aid. And to support communities to come together for reconciliation, peace dialogues and peace talks. One of the successful examples is Tambora, where we established a base in July and are seeing slow but steady progress in the restoration of security and rebuilding of relationships in a very divided community. It's important to note that these are temporary bases. There should not be an expectation amongst communities or authorities that they will become permanent fixtures and somehow take over the responsibility of the government and its agencies to provide security, aid and support to their own people. In addition to our military presence, our police have carried out more than 1,000 patrols and built the capacity of 6,500 local police officers. We've carried out 245 activities to promote and advocate the protection of human rights. Our child protection team has trained more than 1,000 military, police and political actors and raised awareness amongst over 10,000 community members. To support recovery and development, our military engineers have built or repaired 3,200 kilometres of roads, helping communities connect for peace talks, enabling the delivery of aid and boosting trade and economic growth. Our quick impact projects have built 10 police posts, 8 prison or court facilities, 6 medical centres, 5 schools, 3 community centres and other infrastructure such as bridges, boreholes and the provision of solar energy. This helps reduce tension over scarce resources, strengthens law and order, and encourages the safe return of displaced families. Outside of our mandated duties, we've provided vocational training like carpentry and tailoring, and provided veterinarian and medical services, as well as donated medicines, potable water supplies, and other equipment. As I mentioned earlier, we are constantly examining the work that we do to ensure that we are efficient and effective, including looking at new technology and resources to make us more mobile in a logistically difficult environment. We are also working to provide stronger early response to warnings of potential conflict by installing additional temporary bases in areas of concern so that our peacekeepers can more easily provide protection and peace building. In conclusion, I'd like to thank you, the media, for your work in a very challenging environment to keep people informed about the work of the UN, the situation in South Sudan, and your active support for civic engagement in the peace process. We especially expect of you a contribution to the necessary national dialogue that must accompany an electoral process. I'd also like to share my appreciation to the government and people of South Sudan. We work in partnership with you and could not carry out our work without your support. On that note, I send my best wishes to you all as we head into the holiday season. Please stay safe, cherish your time with family and friends, come back in the new year reinvigorated and ready to make a fresh push for peace. Thank you.
Thank you so much. My name is Shual. I work with the radio community. It's good you mentioned that you have visited Unity State and you recently returned from Unity. I do need to know there were concerns from the UN humanitarian coordinator in regard to what he described as a localized youth conflict. Yes, there were concerns that was raised by the UN humanitarian coordinator in what he described as a localized youth conflict happened between youth in armed youth in Unity State. Tell us, what could your effort on this to end this kind of localized youth conflict, since you say that there are 125 temporary bases that has been established in those areas to minimize the conflict? And my last question is in regard to the peace implementation. You say that the peace is at risk unless something needs to be done urgently due to the slow implementation of the agreement, which the president acknowledged. And what really needs to happen? What do you want to see as a major step to ensure that the peace is holding?
Thanks for that question. Good question. I think in regard to the engagement with youth and our experience of a particular volatility and anger on the part of the youth community, some of it directed at humanitarians and NGOs, we would reply that it clearly reflects a high level of frustration at the economic conditions in the country, the political and economic marginalization of the youth, and the need to give special attention to engaging youth, consulting youth, hearing the voices of the youth as we go forward, properly understanding also their aspirations for the future. But we've also drawn a line at the fact that attacks on humanitarians is not a constructive way forward. Humanitarians working in South Sudan, in any event, work in what is commonly referred to as the most dangerous place for humanitarians anywhere in the world. And we think there are constructive ways of engaging with the demands of the youth. I must say, as far as the UN is concerned, we ensure that we have very high percentages of recruitment from locals in the areas in which we work, over 80%. We think while on the one hand we need to address the question of fair labour practices, if that is an issue, the youth also need to recognise the importance of the humanitarian community, which in this country, more than almost any other country, plays a significant role in making up for the failure of government to supply goods and services, vital humanitarian supplies, and particularly food, to the population of the country. The second question is to interrogate me, I suppose, if I can put it that way, on what are the issues that need to be addressed as a priority in implementing the peace agreement. Well, I won't be the first to say that Chapter 2 is the critical priority. Almost all of the stakeholders, the international community, the local community, have all emphasized the need to make progress on the reunification of the forces. I have pointed out to government that I've assured the Security Council at my last briefing that progress was imminent, because that was what we were told. And yet, 3 months later, we still find that the parties haven't taken the necessary steps so that we can see the active reunification of the armed forces, which is nothing less, of course, than creating a truly national security institution owned by the people of South Sudan and mirroring the people of South Sudan. And so echoing what we heard, even at the governor's conference, we would underline the importance of making progress in that area. There are a number of different steps. There's the establishment of the single command structure, which we understand is progress has been made, but we're not quite sure what that progress is as yet. We'd like to see the graduation to the extent that it's possible, the proper supply and support to the training centres so that people can report there. And that's all in relation to Chapter 2. And we note that many of the stakeholders have stressed that Chapter 2 is critical for all of the other steps which have to be taken. In addition to that, I would refer to the legislation which the AUKUS agreement requires the transitional legislature to pass. I think there are 22 pieces of legislation referred to in the agreement. Now, that legislation is important. It provides for economic reform, financial reforms, judicial reforms, provides for the elections, it provides for constitution-making process, and all of those things are critical for this country to make progress along its transitional pathway. And the frustration is that the transitional national legislature was established some time ago, but as yet has not established even the necessary committees to process the legislation which has already been prepared, drafted, and approved by the Council of Ministers. So we would want to emphasize, as I said in my remarks, it can't be business as usual. It can't be the normal lengthy recesses. It's got to be really seen as a work of national importance with some urgency attached.
SRSG, and my name is Waki Simon Udu from the Voice of America Radio VOA. I have three questions, if you may allow. The first one is, what do you mean when you say if this continue, there is a risk that the viability of the border agreement will come under threat? All we know is that currently the parties are implementing the peace agreement. The national legislature has been formed. The national government has been formed. Those of Riek Machar, they're continuing with the meetings with those of President Kiir. This is what appears on SSBC, and this is what South Sudanese know. So when you say if this continue, there is a risk that the viability of the broader agreement will come under threat, what do you mean exactly? That's one. Two, recently on Chapter 2, President Salva Kiir said the main reason why they cannot graduate the unified forces is because of the sanction, the UN sanction, which is arms embargo on South Sudan, and that there are no arms for them to graduate the forces. This is one of the causes that delays the graduation of the unified forces. Do you believe in this narrative by President Salva Kiir? And finally, next week you will be briefing or giving update to the UN to the UN Security Council. What support would you request from the UN Security Council in effort to also, on the side of the international community, to give a fresh energy or to inject fresh energy to move forward the implementation of the peace deal? Thank you.
First issue concerns, what is the impact of not making progress in the implementation of the peace agreement? Well, what we hear from the communities that I visit and the political stakeholders from the top to the bottom is a recognition that we have to make more progress, that the progress has been variously described in the media as glacial or very slow, and the president himself has drawn attention to this. The analogy metaphor I've used is that it's like riding a bicycle. If you're stationary, the bicycle falls over. You've got to keep moving to maintain a level of balance and stability. And so we would recognize that there seems to be expressions of frustration at people who are promised continuously that there will be progress in the implementation of Chapter 2, but we don't see that progress. the two issues that are most often raised. I've mentioned those, the need for an agreement on a single unified command structure and the need to graduate some of the trainees or the trainees based in the training centres. And so that's really what I mean to the threat to the viability. You know, will there come a time in which people say the peace agreement has lost credibility? We're not saying that. We've been saying consistently to people, please believe in the peace agreement. Please work at it. You know, yesterday I was in Unity State with people saying, why hasn't the UNMIS implemented the peace agreement? And I had to say, but it's not for us to implement. It's for you to implement, and we're here to support you. So we need a clear understanding that it's the Sudanese who must implement this agreement. On the question of whether UN sanctions prevents the graduation, you know, I mean, it's possible for the graduation to take many forms, and I wouldn't want to prescribe to those like the Joint Defence Board how it should take place. But there's no necessary condition that the graduands have rifles in their hands when they graduate. Obviously, one would want at the end of the day to see that the security apparatus is properly armed. But for the purposes of graduation, which is a procedural measure so that we can go ahead and integrate the forces, that I think can go ahead. On the UN sanctions, we in the mission do not take a position. We are like the Secretariat. This is a decision taken by the Security Council, and we have no role in implementing it. What can the Security Council do? Well, I think it needs to indicate its continuing support and interest in the Southern Sudan file, if I can put it that way. It has to show a degree of understanding and support for the benchmarks, the achievement of the benchmarks in the peace agreement, which include, of course, the constitution making, establishment of government structures and accountability structures, our work in particular in trying to build what we call a justice chain. You know, one of the things we encounter when we engage in intercommunal conflict is people say, well, what do we do if somebody does wrong to us or takes our cattle? There are no courts, there's no police, there's no prisons. We need you to assist. So we would look to the Security Council to support the work we do in trying to build that that justice chain. In general, if I can talk more generally about our message to the international community, because I suppose when we talk to the Security Council, it's our way also of talking to the international community, is to say that while we appreciate the eyes of the world are on Ethiopia and Sudan, it would be wrong to neglect and walk away from the situation in South Sudan, not to recognize that it's an integral part of this region and needs the same level of interest and support that the other countries in the region are getting.
Thank you so much. My name is Tani Martin from Already Miraya. I have two questions. First is on the flood. According to the Pakistani engineers of the peacekeepers in Bentiu, they are saying that there is a visibility studies they conducted, and they have come up with their finding that the flood is going to last for more than 2 years. And this is going to be very dangerous for the people who are living in that area, and we may expect more rain, like you said, to come next year. So, and right now, like you mentioned, they're trying to construct dikes to protect some of the only government buildings within Bentiu town, not the entire places. So according to what you are seeing on the ground, what are the most likely impact of this long-term flood on the people on the ground? Because we are also seeing on social media that even animals are dying and they are floating over the river. That's number one. And the second question is on the peace agreement. Last week during the fifth governance forum, the interim chairperson of RGMEC said that he is so worried that the parties might not meet the deadline in conducting election at the end of the interim period. that might lead to maybe something like an extension. Does ANMIS also have the same feeling and sentiment that the slow pace of the implementation might lead to further extension?
Well, it was a bit of a shock to go to Bentiu to find that the water is still rising. Still rising. It hasn't started decreasing yet. It's still rising 1 centimeter a day. The engineers tell me that the natural rate of evaporation at the most would be 1 centimeter a day. And if it was to evaporate at 1 centimeter a day, and that would be good, which it's not doing at the moment, it would take 5 months before, or longer, before the waters were had moved from the area. Their estimate is that the water will still be there when the rainy season start next year. And in a context where a lot of the dikes and other infrastructure that's been constructed is already damaged, it could be catastrophic. And so what they're appealing for is a considerable investment in the machinery to pump the water out, to dredge the channels in the Nile, and to excavate and construct new dikes. And that really has to take place before the rainy season next year. This is not something which is in anybody's plan. It's not work which has been budgeted for or planned for. In my view, it's not a project that can be dealt with by one party alone. We've all got to come to the table, member states, the government, the state government, donors, and work together on what is really a critical emergency intervention to protect the area. And of course, you know, the way the waters are moving, it's not something which can be dealt with in Unity State alone. These are waters which move between Yongle, Unity, Zit Lakes, Upper Nile. So you really need a national effort, not just trying to solve the problem in Bentiu by itself. It won't, can't be fixed in that localized way. So that is just to share with you that perspective. I was asked whether the slow pace of implementation might threaten the timing of the elections, and that this comment had been, this observation had emanated from JMAC. We've taken note of it. I would want to believe that if all the parties work together and indicated the political will that's necessary to hold elections, it can be done. But I would also want to emphasize that a lot of work has to be done. Work has to be done by the political parties. Institutions have to be created. The country has to be prepared for elections from top to bottom, from east to west. Elections are a complicated business logistically. You distribute ballot boxes, collect all the ballots, count the ballots. You've got to have transport systems which moves the ballots from maybe 25 or 35,000 different spots, voting stations. So quite a lot of work has to go into preparing the country for elections. Also, the political parties themselves and the other stakeholders need to agree what the rules of the game will be. How exactly will the elections run in a way which meets the aspirations, not of foreigners, but the aspirations of South Sudanese. So we want to limit the possibility of violence before the election, during the election, and after the election if the parties choose not to accept the results. The one way of doing that is to run a professionally conducted and fair, technically satisfactory electoral process. So that's what's at stake. It can be done, but obviously, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that if there's continued absence of any progress on all of those issues that I mentioned and the dialogue that is necessary between stakeholders on how the elections will run, then you won't be able to hold the elections. So we need to make progress on all of the aspects.
Thank you very much. My name is Nicola Mandil. I'm a freelance reporter for the BBC World Service. Just maybe one question to support, to add more on the question my colleague raised about election. Last week, First Vice President Riek Machar met with the senior members of his party in Juba here, and he raised about 5 points that there would be no elections without unified forces. There would be no election without the return of 4 million refugees. No election without census. No election without permanent constitution. So do you as a mission, UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan, do you buy his points? He's like, for him he said no. No election without unified forces. Because there are people supporting the parties to go for what he calls the end game, that is conducting elections, even if the forces are not graduated. So do you accept these points, that these are concerns raised by a party to the agreement, that they will not go for election if the forces are not graduated? Perhaps one would ask, how much is the mission doing really to help the parties graduate the forces? Because this rhetoric sounds like time bombs, if you like. And people believe you have the magic to defuse this time bomb. Thank you.
Let me say, I don't think there's a golden script for the election. The most important aspect of the elections is that South Sudanese agree what the necessary conditions must be. And that can be subject to amendment depending on the circumstances. I've been in countries where they had wanted to wait for refugees to return, but decided at the end to conduct polling inside neighboring countries' refugee camps. It's really a decision for South Sudanese to decide how inclusive and under what conditions they want to hold the election. There's obviously some force in the argument that you want the elections monitored by a security agency that is seen as truly national and impartial. That may be the unified forces, it may not, but it is understandable that people would want impartial electoral management bodies, impartial security forces at the time. So that's my answer. Well, you could, if the parties agree, certainly they could think of an alternative. They could weigh up the prospect of no elections, delay on the elections to form the unified forces. But I would leave that up to South Sudanese to agree. But South Sudanese then require the opportunity to meet and discuss this issue and to agree on it. Yeah. You know, many of these issues were dealt with in the AR-AUKUS. So our default position is just because we support this agreement, and this is an agreement signed by all the stakeholders, including the government and the opposition. First of all, we would want to stress that what the AR-AUKUS says should be followed, because that's what people have agreed to. On the unified forces, you will bear in mind that that aspect of the process was supposed to have been accomplished some time ago. There's been already a delay.
Yes, my name is Moses Warren. I work for Top FM. Yeah, we have been talking of the graduation of a unified force. What were some of the challenges that are leading to the delay of the graduation?
We have been asked to support the process, and we have indicated at every turn our willingness to provide what support UNMIS can give to starting the process, kicking it off, or making sure it works. I don't want to get into the game of pointing fingers. Both sides point fingers at each other as to who's to blame. We remain convinced that if the parties wanted to find a solution, they should be able to do that.
Just clarity. One question. Nicholas, do you believe that the implementation of the South Sudan peace deal currently is under threat?
I think it's only under threat to the extent that the parties are unable to implement it. So it's under threat to the extent the parties don't implement it. And I think it's important to say that an agreement that's not implemented will come under threat, because we want to encourage the parties to treat it with a degree of urgency and to recognize that it can't be business as usual. But you know, the people who are most insistent that this agreement must be implemented are the South Sudanese. It's not something you need to do for foreigners. It's something that the South Sudanese should be concerned to see. And quite frankly, that's our experience. We're only reflecting what South Sudanese are saying.
Bunning, the question is, what kind of support are you giving to help the parties unify the command and graduate the unified forces? Because your mission here is to support the peace agreement. It's not clear what kind of support, how much support have you given to the parties to help them graduate the forces?
We will give whatever support we're asked to give. What we can do is to make our offers in good faith to the parties that we can support them. We can support you in policy or in practice or in design in regard to security sector reform, DDR. We can, in regard to training at the training centres, and so on. We haven't been asked to provide that support. We have made the offers. But it seems that the issues which are forming the blockage are political in nature. It's not the absence of technical solutions which is holding it up.